Yeah, it's very, very nice to be here. I've just literally got the train up from the London Buddhist Centre in Bethnal Green. And I was really struck just coming into the building. It's like coming home, and yet I've just sort of come all the way up here to Manchester and Dharmala kindly came to meet me at the station. It's just really lovely. It's like just coming home. And that's part of the vision of our movement, our spiritual movement, the Sri Ratna Buddhist Order and Community, is it really is a community stretching between continents, stretching across the whole world, so that you can fly to one place, you can get a train to somewhere and still be at home. I don't know, I was just very struck by that, just being here. Anyway, I'm not talking about that. I want to talk about the imagination. In a way, the word talk for this talk is a little bit too grand. That's what it looks like. And so if you want the notes afterwards, there you go. I hope I got more to say than that. Anyway, it's kind of me just talking about the imagination primarily, the difference between imagination and fantasy. And then I'll leave time, I'll stop at some point, possibly not at the end of the talk, but I will stop, you know what I mean, and let you go home. And hopefully there'll be time for some questions. Yeah? Okay, so I want to start by reading a poem by Ted Hughes. It's a very famous poem called The Thought Fox. Does anyone know it? Yeah? It's one person. so it's not that famous. Hughes wrote it. He after quite a long period where he couldn't write, he couldn't find anything to write. And he said the poem just appeared to him and he just wrote it down and didn't change hardly a word. Ted Hughes often actually didn't redraft, he didn't believe in it. He just thought if the moment was there, you just wrote from it and that was it. Sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes that's not a good thing. I wouldn't advise you to copy him in that, but anyway. So I want to read this poem and this poem, in a way, my talk is something of a sort of exploration of this poem and thereby an exploration of imagination. Yeah. And we'll see how we go. The Thought Fox. I imagine this midnight moment's forest. Something else is alive besides the clock's loneliness and this blank page where my fingers move. Through the window I see no star. Something more near, though deeper within darkness, is entering the loneliness. Cold, delicately as the dark snow, a fox's nose touches twig, leaf. Two eyes serve a movement that now, and again now, and now, and now, set neat prints into the snow between trees. And warily a lame shadow lags by stump and in hollow of a body that is bold to come across clearings. An eye, a widening, deepening greenness, brilliantly, concentratedly coming about its own business, till with a sudden sharp, hot stink of fox, it enters the dark hole of my head. The window is starless still. The clock ticks. The page is printed. Yeah, so that's The Thought Fox by Ted Hughes. And in a way, it strikes me as a poem about the nature of imagination. And one of the things I want to do is explore the poem and see how it is a poem about the nature of imagination. And I'll draw things from it as we go on. But, you know, just to look at the first two lines, I imagine this midnight's moment's forest. So we've got the poet here writing on his pad at night. But then something else is alive besides the clock's loneliness. It's interesting that the clock is lonely. So there's already a reflection on time, the tedium of time, the fact that we live in time. And then he talks about this blank page where my fingers move. So something else is alive. And I think it's interesting that he says, but through the window I see no star. So I take that to mean, or I take that to be thinking of divinity or God. So when I look through the window, I see no star. In other words, there's nothing celestial. So when I say something else is alive, it's not something celestial. It's not to do with the stars. It's not to do with the sphere, the sort of planetary spheres from Christianity. He says, through the window I see no star. Something more near. Very odd way of putting that, rather than something nearer. Something more near. Though deeper within darkness. So there's a darkness that's surrounding the poet, and there's something more near, though deeper within that darkness, that is entering the loneliness, presumably the clock's loneliness. Then cold, delicately as the dark snow, a fox's nose touches twig, leaf. I mean, that's beautiful, beautiful. You suddenly see the fox, don't you? Suddenly you, as it says, as delicately as the dark snow. You can really see that beautiful fox's nose just touch a leaf, a twig. That now and again, now and now and now sets prints into the snow. And what Hugh seems to be doing there, he's already talked about the loneliness of the clock, hasn't he? He's already looked out of the window and said, this aliveness I'm feeling has nothing to do with God. Nothing to do with the angelic hierarchy, but something that's alive, that now and now and now. So he's talking about direct experience now. It's not some sort of abstraction. It's now in this deeper darkness. Something now and now and now sets neat prints into the snow. So whatever it is that's alive is going to imprint itself. The snow is obviously also an image, isn't it? Of receptivity, a sort of virgin receptivity, and the fox's feet will print into that. And then later on it says, it describes the fox as coming brilliantly, concentratedly, coming about its own business. Yeah. So you've got these were brilliant, the fox at night, but concentratedly. And he describes the fox's eye as a widening, deepening greenness. It's very interesting that it's coming about its own business. So it's nothing to do with the poet. So he's already said, I'm sitting here, I'm writing on this blank page. Blank is an important word because the blank of the page relates to the blank of the snow. The clock's ticking and I'm stuck in time with the clock. That's how I read it. There's nothing celestial going on, but I feel something alive in this darkness. And that is suddenly conjured into the poem as being a fox. You see the fox moving through the snow outside, and he's coming about its own business, brilliantly, concentratedly. So it's not to do with the poet. And then it says, till with a sudden, sharp, hot stink of fox, it enters the dark hole of the head. Interesting, isn't it, a way of thinking of that your head is a dark hole. But the fox, that he's conjured up so brilliantly outside, with that stink of fox. I don't know whether you've ever taken your dog's walk and they roll in fox dirt. It's an incredible stink. They come up to you and say, whoa! We used to have to hose our Alsatians down in the yard and they'd stand trembling because you couldn't let them in the house and get rid of this awful stink. So this sharp stink of a fox is something very, very strong. And smells for me are often to do with atmosphere, aren't they? It's amazing how atmospheric a smell can be. Sometimes I remember going back to my old school, just a smell. The whole of my school life came back just with that smell of a school, which seemed to have their own smell, or the smell of that cabbage smell in hallways, and so evocative. Creates a whole kind of world, doesn't it? The hot stink of a fox, but that hot stink enters the dark hole of the head. Interestingly, I misread it when I read it. I said the hot dark hole of my head. That's what I'd want to say if I was writing it. But he says the head. So I think he's probably doing that as to say, this isn't a confessional poem, so I'm not, in a way, particularly talking about me. I'm just talking about the head, not my head. Yeah? It would be quite different if he said it enters the dark hole of my head. That suddenly makes it, this is something to do with me. So he's already said that the fox is coming about. I hadn't meant to say any of this. It's not in my notes. Anyway, never mind. He's already said, hasn't he, that the fox is coming about its own business. So if he'd said, enter into my head, that suggests that the fox is interested in him. Do you see what I mean? But it just says, the hole in the head, in the dog hole in the head. Very, very interesting, I think. I hadn't noticed that before. I'm an extrovert, so I think out loud. I need a room full of people in front of me to think. Sometimes people really regret that. Anyway, sometimes I do. And then, so it enters this atmosphere, this sharp stink of fox enters the dark hole of the head, which is our head. Our head. It's the poet's head, but it's our head. And then he says, interestingly, the window is starless still. So he seems to me to be emphasising, I'm not talking here about some kind of literal divine thing. It's not an angel that he's imagined into the darkness. It's not even a fox, obviously, because it's the stink that has entered his head. He's trying to say, I think, that, don't get me wrong, just be clear, there's no stars suddenly appeared in the window here. There's no divine transformation. We're not somewhere else now, and yet somehow we are. And he says the clock ticks. So time seems still to be happening, and yet you feel, don't you, when you read the poem, that time is somehow suspended. That now and now and now, that repetition of that. There are three nows there. And again now, no, there's four, and that now, and again now, and now, and now, somehow suspends time. But as it were, the clock's time continues. It's not a literal suspension of time, even. It's not that the clock stops, the clock ticks. And then the very, very famous last line, the page is printed. So you get to the end of the poem, the poet has evoked this aliveness, and it's that aliveness that's come into the poem and created the poem. The page is printed. This wonderful last line, because it perfectly unifies the act of writing with the fox walking across the snow, the blank of the page with the blank of the snow. And he wrote that in just one inspiration. It's been anthologized again and again. Actually, I've never talked about it at length, but I'm glad I have now. So yeah, the other page is printed. So this animating presence that he hasn't conjured up, he's found in the darkness, that's found him, actually. It's interesting that the fox is coming about his own business. I think that's very, very important. And the fox has found him. He hasn't found the fox, in a way. It's the fox that's been coming. He hasn't said, and I'm thinking about a fox, or I'll conjure up a fox. The fox has found him, entered into his head, and between them, miraculously, the page is printed. Yeah. So I think, in a way, if you look at it like that, I hadn't meant to do that, but if you do look at it like that, you see a kind of essay on the nature of imagination. Everything I want to say about imagination, effectively, I hadn't realised it until I explored it a bit more. I wasn't going to, but now that I explore it more, everything I want to say about the imagination is in that poem. It is a poem about the nature of imagination. Hi there, there's a seat here at the front if you sit down a seat. So the main thing I want to say about imagination, so if you don't remember any of my other points, just this is the main point, is that imagination always goes somewhat beyond you. Yeah? In a way, that's a crucial point about imagination, that when something is genuinely an act of imagination, it always goes beyond you. And I want to explore what that might mean. Let's just make a few other things clear whilst I'm on the subject. So imagination is a tricky word, a bit like spiritual is a tricky word, or indeed religion. In fact, most words are tricky when you look at them. But imagination is a tricky word, and very little is left of what Coleridge meant by imagination. He was trying to use it as a way of exploring, I think, what Hughes is exploring here. It's come to mean, people often say, oh, that's just your imagination. It's come to mean something really, I think, quite trivial and quite debased. It's become part of the entertainment industry. It's become something that sort of adds a kind of flourish on top of things. Sometimes when people are being so-called imaginative, actually they're not being imaginative at all. It's just the same old thing with a kind of outlandish outfit, you know, a sort of silly hat and a red nose, carrying a pair of novelty boxer shorts or something like that. You know, I mean, it's just a sort of, you know, sort of gag. I'll say more about that in a second. So when I'm talking about imagination, we need to hold the word fairly lightly. It has been very debased, and I mean something, and I think Hughes means something very profound by it. Actually, when you read Hughes's poem, it's a very profound poem, as Hughes's best is. Actually, Hughes risks being profound. Nowadays, poets often won't risk that, but Hughes risks being profound. So he means something profound by imagination, so do I, and this talk is coming out of my understanding, particularly of Bhante Sangharakshita's teaching on imagination and Subbuti's exploration of that more recently. So let's be clear what imagination is. Let's hold it lightly. We could call it just X. And also, whilst we talk about X that we're calling imagination, let's not get too fixated on art. I'm a bit of an arty person, as you know. Imagination is the area of life the arts is the area of life that is usually talked about in terms of imagination. It's probably the easiest area of life to talk about the imagination relationship to, and also I'm temperamentally rather biased in that way. But imagination isn't really to do with the arts. I mean, a lot of the arts simply aren't imagination at all. It also includes the best of science. It includes but mathematics. Imagination includes the whole, I think, of spiritual life, and it includes any worthwhile endeavour by anyone, whether it's you deciding to be a bit friendly to somebody on the train rather than unfriendly. That itself is an act of imagination. Human beings are imagination, or at least could be. And in a way, one of the main things I want to stress in the talk is that one of our great tasks in life is to discover the imagination, whatever that means yet, we still haven't completely cleared about it, to unleash it and to become more and more a living act of imagination, whether that's imagining the reality of others, imagining other life apart from your own, imagining seeing the thought fox appearing in your mind. They're all acts of imagination. In a way, human beings are kind of an instant of imagination, at least at best. They're a kind of embodying of imagination. So let's not get too hooked up on art, even though that's what I use as my reference, particularly poetry, because I've been reading a lot of poetry. And writing poetry. But that's not important whether you do that or not. What's important is not whether you paint pictures or write poems, but whether you find the imagination and explore it and develop it. I think that's also true of even things like administration or work, running a centre and so on. They're all acts of imagination. Gosh, I've gone on already too long. And one other caveat is to make the distinction between fancy or fantasy and imagination. So Coleridge contrasts imagination with fancy, as he calls it. And actually, I think there's more to say about fancy or fantasy. But a simple way of talking about the difference between imagination and fancy is in fancy, for Coleridge's point of view, nothing new comes into the work. Nothing new appears in you. It's the same old you. As I think Iggy Pop said, it's the same old whatever in Brand New Drag. Can't remember it now. The same old you in Brand New Drag. So fancy is just, if it's a poet, it's the same old poet, but with an outlandish costume on and a big hat. And they usually write poems about underarm deodorants and zebras and oranges and mix all that together. And you think that's very imaginative. Do you see what I mean? Because it's got imagination written on everything, so this is very imaginative. In rituals, sometimes people decide to do an imaginative ritual, And sometimes they have that same quality of everything has to be imaginative, and it's not really imaginative at all. It's just sort of fanciful. So in fancy, all that's happening is you're getting the same things and putting them together in an unusual and arbitrary order, which gives it a bit of a ooh, but it doesn't have any deeper coherence. Especially nothing new comes into it. Nothing is discovered. Nothing is new is unearthed. It's just, you kind of put lots of things in a liquidizer, sort of stir them on and pour them into a different mould and hope that that will do it. Yeah? Nothing genuinely new has come out. So a lot of what we call imagination really is fancy, in Coleridge's terms, or fantasy. Also, it strikes me that imagination, and especially the arts, because the arts, unfortunately, has got this kind of kudos, hasn't it? And that's, in many ways, not a good thing. It would be better if the arts were on the same sort of playing field as football. Well, I'm on a playing field. Or and science, and, I don't know, as I say, administrational work. That it's a job of work, and so on, yeah. Yeah, so let's try to remember sort of all that. So I just want to go through how many metaphors I've got. 6 metaphors, yeah. The metaphor of otherness. Ooh, hello.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, go on.
But you mentioned the contrast between imagination and fantasy by Coleridge, but could you elaborate a bit more on what he defines by imagination?
In a way, these 4 metaphors are my attempt to do that. Yes, on my attempt to do that, I hope. Let's see. Ask me again at the end, could you define what you meant by it? You said you were going to. Oh, yes, that's what I was going to say, that imagination as fancy easily just becomes a part of your... Oh, that's right, I was halfway through a sentence, wasn't I? I knew that I was halfway through. I was saying that the arts can become... they've got this sort of kudos, haven't they? So it's well known, for instance, that artists rent studios and never go to them. There's lots of blocks of studios where people rent them at quite high cost but don't go. It's a very well-known phenomena. And it's because you hope that by getting a studio that'll make you paint, but you just don't. Anyway, it costs you a lot of money. But people are obviously doing that because they're really hooked into the kudos of being an artist. Even so much they'll spend money on a studio even though they're not doing anything. Sometimes I think the arts can just become part of your personal style. I've got a friend of mine who's a surfer, and he's got 3 surfboards. He wears kind of surfy clothes. He has those trousers that don't seem to stay up very easily, miraculous trousers. He has sort of Billy Bong things, and there's a whole sort of surf style. Actually, he's not that much like that, but you can then imagine going to surfy cafes, having a certain one of those little thinny dreadlock things down the back, always having a slight tan. It's just a kind of style thing, isn't it? You're a sort of surfy kind of person. And art can be like that as well. It's just part of your personal style. So you do paintings and write little poems and sort of wear a cravat. And it's just part of your personal style, yeah? But that's nothing to do with imagination, yeah? Nothing to do with imagination at all. And often if art is rather obviously part of someone's personal style, I think it's a bad sign. All the people I've looked up to as artists and writers are just sort of very, very ordinary, and they haven't got time to make it part of their personal style. Okay, let's go look at these promised 6 metaphors, and I'll try and be fairly brief. So I want to talk about the metaphor of otherness, the metaphor of aliveness, the metaphor of discovery, the metaphor of play, the metaphor of unity, and the metaphor of ascent. And I'm doing all this because in my mind is a sort of aphorism by Bhante where he once said, Bhante Sangharakshita, the founder of our movement, once said that if we were to look for predecessors to Buddhism in the West, it would be better to look to the arts rather than to look to religion as being the sort of ground in which Buddhism arises from. So in other words, it's got more in common with the arts than it has with religion, even with my caveats to that. So by the arts, Bhante means, Sangharakshita means this enlivened imagination. So the first thing is this metaphor of otherness. So you've got that in the poem, that the thought fox is coming about its own business. It's not to do with you. In other words, essentially, something unwilled enters the picture. Something unwilled enters you. And this can be in a meditation, in a communication, it can be in something that you're writing, it can just be in your being, that some new element comes in which you haven't willed into being. Yeah? So it's interesting that in the poem he just says, I imagine this midnight moment's forest. So he's just imagining this world, and something steps into that world, literally. Something new comes in, something that you haven't willed into being. Yeah? It's the new, it's the genuinely new, the unlooked for, the unwilled. Yeah? Imagination, genuine imagination, always has that sense. And that's often experienced as literally coming from outside. Hughes in the poem tries to tread a path between saying it literally comes out from outside and it's something I've imagined. So he starts with, I imagine. So in that he's saying, this is me imagining. But he loses that, doesn't he, as he goes on, and actually the fox just appears until it goes into his head. He's trying to tread this path between a literal other and just the imagination. And Buddhism is trying to tread exactly that path, that we're not saying it isn't stars, there's not a God literally out there, but neither is it you. It's not just you finding a deeper you, not even in that psychological sense. It's not a kind of depth psychology. Buddhism isn't a depth psychology. It's trying to say that in experience itself, built into experience itself, is something other than you, something more than you, something which, if it steps into you, prints the page, creates something fully new. Yeah, it's not the stars. The window is cloudless still. Interesting as well, it's very important that Hughes stresses that it's natural. It's not an angel. It's not some kind of just like a ghost. It's a natural thing. Something else is alive. It's something natural. It's deeper in darkness. So it's mysterious, but it's alive. And it's alive in nature, in Hughes's poem, isn't it? It's not outside of nature, in supernature, like God. And he's quite explicitly said that, hasn't he? That it's not outside nature, because there's no stars. Yeah, it's alive in nature, and it steps into you. With a sharp, hot stink of fox, it steps into the use atmosphere, which you want to call something like the divine, steps into you. And the thing to really notice in Hughes and in Buddhism is it's not literally other and it's not literally you. But something new arises, yeah? Something unwilled. Yeah? So that's the first thing that's in a way the defining stamp of imagination. Some new thing arises. Yeah? And then I want to explore, just briefly talk about the metaphor of aliveness. So when something, when the imagination steps into experience, things become more alive. There's a sudden access of energy. Now this is, for those of you who meditate, it's very, very obvious when this happens in meditation. You know, you're just sort of thinking, you're just doing that sort of tumble dryer mind, you know, and go round and round, and there's a 50 pence piece, and you know, that's so often what our mind is. And sometimes, I don't know, you just something happens, you might say something to yourself or just go back to the breath, and suddenly that mind goes quiet and something new arises. And you're suddenly more alive. In fact, you're suddenly genuinely alive. And this is also true of imagination in any kind of art. When the thought fox enters the dark hole of your head, the page is printed. Something lives. And when this is what you can experience very strongly when you have a decent reading of a poem or a good listening to a concert or a good film, you feel that the thing itself is alive from its own side, don't you? You feel that something of the aliveness of a subject has been impregnated into the object. I remember seeing a carving by Michelangelo of Brutus's head in Florence. And it's quite a rough carving. I don't even know whether Michelangelo would have thought it was finished. But I looked at it and it wasn't just an object anymore. There were lots of objects, but you couldn't reduce it to an object. There was something, as it were, alive about it. It seemed to have its own subjectivity. It seemed to have an aliveness to it, which was palpable. I mean, you could miss that, of course, but I felt in a receptive state, it was undoubtedly alive. Yeah? So anything that's genuine and imaginative creates this new energy, and it's the energy that we really want and need. It's not merely the energy of being energetic, it's a new kind of energy, something alive in nature, yeah? And it's alive in the stone, or it's alive in the poem. Sometimes you read a poem, very rarely, and the poem itself is alive. It's almost as if the poem is experiencing you, not just you experiencing it. And of course, what happens with that aliveness, it seems to make us more alive. So when we read deeply, when we meditate deeply, when we communicate with someone deeply, we become more alive. And that's what we really want, don't we? Bhante once said that if you don't like the language of the transcendental, just replace it with more life. So there's just more life. When something is touched by, in Auden's phrase, immortal fire, there's more life. You become more alive. The object seems more alive. And what's even more mysterious, the relationship between subject and object becomes much more difficult to express. You could say there's almost like a sort of intersubjectivity. You feel a kind of relationship. And you can do this really strongly, can't you, in a book. You read a novel and you feel yourself to be in real relationship with the characters. You feel for them and they almost interact with you. So it's difficult to finish sometimes because you don't want to leave them behind. Yeah? So there are some things I want to say about the metaphor of aliveness. But then you have this metaphor of discovery. You feel in the moment of imagination that imagination has been discovered. It's not you. You've discovered it. Yes, you've discovered it. And in a way, this is an important part of our spiritual practice. You're trying to wait. You're trying to imagine this midnight's moment's forest. It's interesting that it's midnight, isn't it? Because it's this place of quietness, of darkness. Darkness is very often a symbol of leaving behind the ordinary world of things to do and that sort of thing. It's just dark. And in that darkness, you discover something. It's probably this is what Keats was trying to get at when he wrote of what he called negative capability. He said that it was a question of being in uncertainties, mysteries and doubts without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. It's a very, very good way of putting it. In a way, an aspect of meditation is just that, this negative capability, being with uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without an irritable reaching after fact and reason. It's lovely, that word, irritable. We want to pin things down. And we want to pin things down because we want to know that we know. We want to feel that we're the one in charge. We're absolutely not. But we're deeply insecure in our being. So we have to sort of pin it down with words. And as soon as we pinned it down with words, we're sort of superior to it. That irritable reaching after fact and reason. I'm not arguing against fact and reason because they're very, very important. But we also need to wait for something that goes beyond fact and reason, that transcend them, that don't obliterate them. It's interesting going through the poem just then. Actually, when you go through it, it's as tightly argued as any argument, isn't it? If you go through it image by image, every image is exactly what the poet means. And it's as tightly argued as any philosophical argument. It's just arguing it in images rather than in concepts. Schopenhauer famously said that philosophy is doing in abstracto what art is trying to do in concreto. So that the philosopher abstractly tells you about the nature of reality, whereas an artist tries to show it you. By artist here, he means something much deeper than what we mean by artist. So he believed, for instance, that Shakespeare was the greatest mind outside of philosophy, just as Kant was the greatest mind in philosophy. He felt that Kant had used his fantastic reason he had to see how things are in terms of abstract reasoning, but Shakespeare had just shown you it. He'd shown you our human predicament. I think when we think about imagination, it's got the rigour of highly philosophical thought, but it's been wholly translated into music, into meditation, into communication, into image. Yeah? But it's just as rigorous as that, and should be able to be explored in that way, in the right way. Of course, you can explore things to death. So yes, we need to discover the imagination. We can never be imaginative. This is something that I've really been wanting to stress. We ourselves are never imaginative. Imagination is always eclipses us for a moment. By its very definition, we can't be imaginative. As soon as we try to be imaginative, we're being fantastical. We're entering into fantasy. Because fantasy is just like your ego kind of polished up and given a big hat. Imagination has nothing to do with your ego. Yeah, it's something much more than that. I could talk a bit more about the metaphor of play, but I'll just make two very broad things about play, which is that there's something playful about imagination. It can't be willed. It can't be dragooned. You can't write poems, for instance, along ideological grounds. And if you do try to, even if they're the best possible grounds, they never work. I've been trying to write for about 3 years a long spiritual poem. I won't go on about it. Anyway, I've been trying to write it for ages. And I still haven't finished. It's driving me mad. I'm on draft 60 or something, 3 years later. I'm trying to have it up. You know, to have it up. But actually, as the more I'm writing, the more the clearer it is, actually the poem wants to get down, further and further down. By the end, it's a kind of complete fall away from spiritual life, rather than I wanted that, but it doesn't seem to want to do that. It just wants to do that, you see. And I don't want it to do that because I don't believe in that. But actually, I'm not in charge. You see? And I just grudgingly think, oh, okay, perhaps I'm better. Anyway, there you go. Imagination has its own kind of, its own spirit. You can see where the muse comes from, that something else is alive in the darkness. And that something else that's alive in the darkness is alive in the darkness of meditation. And we have images for it, the Buddha image particularly. We have all these different images from the whole of the Buddhist tradition. But there's something else is alive in the darkness. I mean, those images might work for you, they might not. They need to be played with. They need to be explored. They're not a dot-to-dot guide of imagination. You can't do that. Imagination can't be run along lines. Yeah? This is why actually it's so important in Buddhism to clarify your views, but that's a whole other talk. Also, there's something unexpected about imagination. It often comes in when you're least expecting it. You know, you're meditating away, nothing's happening, and you say to yourself, nothing's happening, suddenly it's happening. You think, how did that happen? I remember I was doing my sadhana at one point, and I only had 15 minutes, because I was late, and so I only had 15 minutes. So I just sat down and said, this isn't going to, I don't know why I'm bothering, because suddenly there was the image of glory straight in front of me. I said, oh, I'm really sorry, I've only got 15 minutes, why have you turned up now? You know, why are you? Oh dear, you know. But there it was, you know, I don't know how that happened. It was, you know, in the moment before I would never have imagined it. So often imagination takes place unexpectedly. It appears from the corner of your eye. If you try too hard, you block it. Funny, you do need to try. So you do need to sit down and meditate. You do need to concentrate. Interestingly, one of the qualities of the thought fox is it's concentrated. Its eye are widening, deepening greenness. So it's this incredible vision of concentration. It's not the concentration that you have on your homework. Not that anybody's that age. But, it's not that kind of concentration. It's a widening, deepening greenness. So you need to do the work on your side. You need to do the concentration. You need to take up spiritual practice. And then you need something needs to step into that darkness. And then just the metaphor of unity. This is very important as well. I've been reading some articles by contemporary poet Don Patterson. Some of those articles are going to, I just don't understand a word of, but that's another matter. But one of the articles, he says that it's as if a poem is just trying to be one word, that eventually it's just one word, that the poem is so unified that you couldn't take anything out of it and you couldn't put anything else into it. It's just one thing. You can't subtract anything from it. And again, that's a, you go back to your question, that's a really classic sign of the imagination at work in any sphere, is it's whole. Just as Hughes's poem is whole, you couldn't take anything out of it. Everything knows about everything else. There's a lovely series of letters on Cezanne by Rilke. He went to these exhibitions of Cezanne. And he said it's as if every colour knows about every other colour, that every part of the painting knows about every other part of the painting. And, I mean, Cezanne is, I think, a brilliant example of that. There's an incredible sense of unity. Everything in the painting relates to each other. So when imagination's at work, there's this complete coming together of things. There's a sort of internal ramification. Everything sort of echoes back to itself and creates more and more of itself. And this unity, you can sometimes experience it outside and that unifies you, can't you? You've had that experience when you go and see a concert. I mean, I remember once listening to a Mozart piano concerto, like a movement of it. And sometimes you have this sense with Mozart that it's this perfect arc of music, that every moment of the music knows about all the other moments. It said that symphonies would come complete to his mind. He'd just have the whole symphony, and then he had to write it out in time. But the whole symphony would just appear in his mind, and then he'd write it out, sometimes on the back of in his carriage on the way, you know, he'd just write the whole thing out. So the imagination is an experience of unification, and it's a unification of the person, at least in that moment. It's the expression of a unified psyche. Only a unified psyche can go deeper, and only a deeper psyche can unleash the imagination. One of the great tasks of spiritual life is this unification of all of our psycho-spiritual energies, so that in that unity something can step into it. Yeah. So in any genuine act of imagination, there's always this unity, this sense of coming together. And as I say, that's true of communication, isn't it, when you're just talking to someone. Sometimes you're actually fully interested and fully there, and everything comes together. So much so that when you finish the communication, you can't remember quite what came before, what after, as if the time and now and now and now is somehow suspended. So imagination is the unification of the person. Imagination is a word for that unification. When you're deeply unified in that way, you have become an instant of imagination. And then finally and lastly, the metaphor of ascent. So this is more difficult to talk about, so I've left it the least time to talk about. Imagination acts as an intermediary. When it is genuine imagination, not fantasy, it acts as an intermediary between who you are just now, your ordinary day-to-day self, and something that goes completely beyond you. It gets difficult to talk about because when we say that, we always want to get into this either-or of Western life. Either it's outside, therefore God or something like God, or it's inside and it's depth psychology. We're trying to say that there's a third alternative, a mystical third alternative. Something else is alive in the darkness, is that mystical third alternative. Yes, and the imagination is this intermediary between, as it were, outside, as it were, inside. So, for instance, it's very clear for this, if you're doing a Buddhana Smriti practice, I've been doing this a while ago when I was at Gukiloka. It's the way you just bring the Buddha to mind. And, you know, you bring the Buddha to mind in various ways. You just think of him. You imagine him. You imagine him being near you, perhaps. Or you imagine his absence. You feel his absence. And you feel if he could be present in some way. So I was doing it one time and imagining him, and what, is he absent, is he present? I don't know. He's sort of not quite absent, but not quite present either. And I suddenly thought, oh, every time I act, and it's such an obvious thought, sometimes when you think in meditation the thoughts go deeper, but I just thought, oh yes, of course, every time I act more kindly, more courageously, more truthfully, more genuinely, I get closer to the Buddha. In that very moment, I'm closer to the Buddha. And as I thought that, suddenly I was. I experienced myself as being closer to the Buddha, or rather the Buddha being closer to me. It just opened a door for his presence, as it were, something else alive in the darkness, stepped into me. Not with a hot, sharp smell of stink of fox. But there's something in that, the pungency of that metaphor, that's right. It's not that something sweet and gentle and smelling of incense stepped into me either. It's got a pungency. It's got a even a threateningness in a certain sense, threatening to your ego. It's not you, you see. And it stepped inside of you. What are you going to do with that? You're suddenly more than anything you thought you were. So suddenly, do you see how my thinking was like, you know, putting a kite up, and suddenly that kite had been hit by lightning. That's what imagination can do. It becomes this image that can be touched by something from beyond the image. Yeah. And we want to say, is that beyond, the literal beyond, and we want to say no to that. But we don't want to say no too much, because it's not a literal me either. There's some other alternative. Something else is alive in the darkness. Imagination wants to ascend to higher and higher levels. I mean, if you just think of Mozart's experience of the whole symphony appearing in his mind, I can't think what that must mean. Somehow he knows the whole thing, and all he needs to do is write it out. The poet Rilke said that there was a time in his life he was writing these sonnets to Orpheus. He wrote 27 sonnets, I think, in 3 days. Many of them are considered to be masterpieces. And he said he's never experienced such an experience of just dictation. He said, all I needed to do was write down what I was told. I just wrote it down, and there they were, 27 sonnets in 3 days. Many of them are masterpieces. As imagination ascends, you get a greater and greater sense of unity, of aliveness, of spontaneity, even of play. All of that ascends as well, if you see what I mean. So do you see that this is what spiritual life is? This would be a good way of talking about spiritual life, because it doesn't... For me, it speaks. I want to do that. I want to experience my imagination ascending into something being alive. Something that's not me. I'm so bored of me. I do the same jokes. I'm kind of this kind of person. I'm all right, you know what I mean? Nice enough, you know, not as young as I'd like to be. It's all just me. It's just we've all got just a few coins to rattle in our tin, haven't we? And, you know, you come to Manchester, people laugh at your jokes because they've not heard them before, think you're a terribly charming person. But then if it was every night, you think, actually, can we have somebody else now? Because I've got a bit bored of this me. It's just the same old coins rattling in your tin. There needs to be some way beyond that few coins in your tin that doesn't then end up with a literal beyond that gets you into all sorts of other problems. Yeah? So let me just finish by reading the poem again and leave us with this act of imagination, because imagination is an act, it's not a theory. Any theory of imagination is often not very imaginative. Luckily this isn't my theory, it's Coleridge's, it's Bante's, it's Sabuti's. So let's try and finish with an act of imagination. The thought fox. I imagine this midnight moment's forest. Something else is alive, besides the clock's loneliness and this blank page where my fingers move. Through the window I see no star. Something more near, though deeper within darkness, is entering the loneliness. Cold, delicately as the dark snow, a fox's nose touches twig and leaf. Two eyes serve as movement that now and again now and now and now, set neat prints into the snow between trees, and warily a lame shadow lags by stump and in hollow of a body that is bold to come across clearings. And I, a widening, deepening greenness, brilliantly, concentratedly coming about its own business, till, with a sudden sharp, hot stink of fox, it enters the dark hole of the head. The window is starless still. The clock ticks. The page is printed. Thank you.